This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Escaping from Houdini, written by Kerry Maniscalco, read by Nicola Barber. This program contains a bonus PDF. To those who believe in the magic of dreams, everything is possible. Hell is empty, and all the devils are here. The Tempest, Act 1, Scene 2. 1. Moonlight Carnival. RMS Etruria, Liverpool, England. 1 January, 1889. New Year's afternoon aboard the Etruria began like a fairy tale, which was the first indication a nightmare lurked on the horizon, waiting, as most villains do, for an opportunity to strike. As our cruise liner prepared to leave port, I ignored twinges of unease in favor of the lush fantasy world before us. It was the start of a fresh year, a new chapter, a wonderful opportunity to put dark events of the past behind us and stare ahead into the bright future. A future that might soon bring a wedding, and a wedding night. I took a steadying breath and glanced at the stage in the center of the grand dining saloon. Heavy velvet curtains, an ink blue so dark they appeared black, shimmered with tiny sparkling gems whenever light caught them. Aerial performers in diamond-encrusted bodices twirled on silver threads, beautiful spiders spinning webs I was hopelessly caught up in. Round tables dotted the floor like well-placed constellations, their moon-white linens strewn with flowers in purples, creams, and blues. Among many modern conveniences, the Etruria boasted a hothouse, and the scents of jasmine, lavender, and other midnight notes wafted around, inviting yet dangerous, not unlike the masked performers soaring above us. They swung effortlessly from one trapeze to the next, letting go without fear of falling as they flew through the air and snatched the next bar with ease. The long trains on their costumes make them look like shooting stars, don't they? I should love to have a dress made with as many gemstones one day. Miss Prescott, daughter of the chief magistrate across the table, sighed deeply. With her caramel hair and cunning brown eyes, she reminded me of my cousin Liza. She set her champagne flute down and leaned close, dropping her voice to a conspiratorial whisper. Have you heard the legend of Mephistopheles, Miss Wadsworth? I tore my gaze from the hypnotic scene above once more and shook my head. I can't say that I have. Is that what tonight's performance is based on?
I suppose it's time for a story.
Captain Norwood, the proud captain of the Etruria, cleared his throat, gaining the attention of our table, including the Prescotts, Uncle Jonathan, my chaperone, Mrs. Harvey, and the wickedly enchanting Mr. Thomas Cresswell, the young man who'd won my heart as deftly as any card sharp winning hand after hand at his game of choice. Accompanied by my uncle, Thomas and I had spent 2 grueling days traveling from Bucharest to Liverpool to board the Etruria before it set out for New York. We'd found creative ways of stealing kisses on our journey, and each secret encounter flashed through my mind unbidden, my hands in his dark brown hair, his lips igniting flames along my skin. Miss Prescott gently nudged me under the table, returning my attention to the conversation.
If, of course, legends are to be believed, named after a character from German folklore, Mephistopheles is a demon in the devil's employ,
Captain Norwood said.
Known for stealing the souls of those already corrupt, he's full of magic and trickery, and he happens to be one spectacular showman. Here, look at these tarot cards he's made for the tables. Each card features one of his performers.
He held up a gorgeous set of hand-painted cards.
I guarantee you're in for a week of unparalleled magic and mystery, he continued. Each night will bring a new carnival performance, never before seen. This ship will be the talk of legends, mark my words. Soon every cruise liner will host similar entertainments. It will be the start of a new era of travel.
I raised a brow at his near-reverent tone. Are you suggesting you've hired a demon to entertain us, and it's sure to become all the rage, Captain?
Thomas choked on his water, and Miss Prescott shot me a mischievous grin.
"Is there a church or chapel on the ship?"
she asked, all round eyes and innocence.
"What shall we do if we're tricked out of our souls, sir?"
The captain lifted a shoulder, enjoying the mystery.
"You'll both have to wait and see. It shan't be much longer now."
He returned his attention to the adults, when Miss Prescott leapt up from her seat, startling me and earning a disapproving glare from her father.
"One more little clue, please."
Maybe it was the devil in me, but I couldn't help adding, "I would hate to be so overcome with hysteria that I abandoned the ship. We're not too far from port, are we? Perhaps I might swim." Miss Prescott slowly blinked in appraisal.
"Indeed, Captain. In fact, I feel a bit of a fainting spell coming on this very moment. Do you think it's Mephistopheles?"
she asked, voice rising in pitch.
"Does his trickery work from a distance? I wonder how many he can affect at once."
I peered at her, leaning in as if to medically inspect her.
"You do appear a bit pale, Miss Prescott. Does your soul feel attached to your person?"
Thomas snorted, but didn't dare interrupt this new show taking place. With my deep blue silk evening gown, midnight gloves that extended past my elbows, and sparkling jewels draped over my collarbone, I felt nearly as bedazzling as the acrobats flying above us. Miss Prescott wrapped her gloved hands around her throat, eyes going wide.
"You know, I do feel strange. Lighter, even."
She swayed on her feet and clutched her center.
"Should we call for smelling salts, Captain?"
"I don't believe it's necessary,"
he said, inhaling deeply, no doubt regretting pairing the two of us together.
"I assure you, this Mephistopheles is harmless. He is just a man pretending to be a legendary villain, nothing more."
"I swear my soul is getting weaker. Can you tell? Do I look more transparent?"
Her eyes grew nearly to the size of saucers as she dropped into her seat and glanced around.
"I wonder if there's a spirit photographer aboard. I've heard they can capture such things on film. My clothing isn't becoming indecent, is it?"
"Not yet." I bit my lip, trying to keep the smile out of my voice and off my face, especially since Mrs. Prescott seemed ready to burst from fury at her daughter's act.
"We might be able to weigh you, to see if there's any difference."
Uncle paused his conversation with Thomas, shaking his head ever so slightly. But before he could comment, an attendant hurried over and handed him a telegram. He read it, twisting the ends of his pale moustache, and folded the paper up, shooting me an inscrutable look.
"If you'll excuse me,"
Uncle stood, "I must tend to this at once." Miss Prescott's eyes sparkled.
"Your uncle must be off on secret forensic business. I've read stories in the papers regarding your involvement with the Ripper murders. Did you and Mr. Cresswell truly stop a vampire in Romania from slaying the king and queen?"
"I... what?" I shook my head.
"People have been writing about me and Thomas in the papers."
"Indeed."
Miss Prescott sipped her champagne, eyes following Uncle as he exited the room.
"Most everyone in London has been whispering about you and your dashing Mr. Cresswell."
I could not focus on the spectacle my own life was taking on. "Pardon me, I must get some air." I half rose, unsure if I should follow Uncle, when Mrs. Harvey patted my hand.
"I'm sure everything is fine, dear," she nodded toward the stage. "It's about to begin." Tendrils of smoke unfurled around the inky curtains, the scent strong enough to evoke a few coughing fits throughout the room. My nose burned, but it was a minor nuisance compared to how quickly my pulse now raced. I wasn't sure if it was Uncle's swift departure, the information regarding Thomas and myself being known for our forensic skills, or the anticipation of tonight's performance that was to blame. Perhaps it was all three.
"Ladies, gentlemen,"
a deep male voice intoned from everywhere at once, forcing passengers to twist in their seats. I craned my own head around, searching for the man behind the disembodied voice. He must have engineered some mechanism to project himself around the room.
"Welcome to the show."
A buzz shot through the saloon as those few words echoed. In the silence that followed, cymbals trilled lightly, building into a crescendo that clashed
as servers lifted silver cloches from our plates, revealing a meal fit for royalty. No one seemed to notice the mushroom gravy-topped fillets or fried potatoes that were arranged in a grand pile, our hunger no longer for food, but to hear that mysterious voice once more. I peeked at Thomas and smiled. He moved about in his seat as if hot coals had been placed randomly and he had to shift or remain still and get burned.
"Nervous?"
I whispered as the aerial performers gracefully descended, one by one.
"Of a performance that boasts of causing arrhythmia, according to this program?"
He flicked the black and white striped showbill he held.
"Not at all. I cannot wait for my heart to burst. Really livens up an otherwise monotonous Sunday evening, Wadsworth."
Before I could respond, a drum thundered, and a masked man emerged from a cloud of smoke in the center of the stage. He wore a frock coat the color of an opened vein, and a starched shirt, and trousers that were an endless black. Scarlet ribbons and silver bullion trimmed his top hat, and a burnished filigree mask covered everything from his nose up. His mouth curved in wicked delight as every eye in the saloon went to him and each jaw dropped. Men jumped in their seats, women's fans snapped open, the sound akin to 100 birds taking flight. It was unsettling, witnessing a man materialize, unscathed by the tempest raging about him. Whispers of him being the devil's heir reached my ears, or Satan himself, as Miss Prescott's father would have it. I nearly rolled my eyes. I should hope he'd have better judgment as a chief magistrate. This was clearly the ringmaster.
"Allow me to introduce myself."
The masked man bowed, mischief sparkling in his eyes as he slowly drew himself back up.
"I am Mephistopheles, your guide through the strange and magnificent. Each night, the Wheel of Fortune will choose your entertainer. However, you may barter with performers after the main show and indulge in any of our acts. From flame swallowers to lion tamers, fortune tellers and knife throwers, your wish is our command. I warn you, though, beware of midnight bargains. Taking your fate in your own hands is poorly advised."
Passengers fidgeted, probably wondering at the sort of bargains they might make, how low they might fall in the pursuit of pleasure, so far from society's watchful shores.
"Our tricks might appear sweet, but I promise they are not treats,"
he whispered.
"Are you brave enough to survive? Perhaps you'll be another who loses their heart and their head to my midnight minstrel show. Only you can decide. Until then..."
Mephistopheles prowled on stage, a caged animal waiting for an opportunity to strike. My heart thudded wildly. I had the distinct impression we were all prey, dressed in our finest, and if we weren't careful, we'd be devoured by his mysterious show.
"Tonight is the first of seven in which you will be dazzled."
The ringmaster lifted his arms, and a dozen white doves flew from his sleeves into the rafters. A few excited cries erupted, Mrs. Harvey and Miss Prescott among the first.
"And horrified,"
he continued, a slight croak now in his voice. From one blink to the next, his tie was no longer made of cloth. It was a writhing snake, wrapping itself about his neck. Mephistopheles clutched his throat, his bronze face turning a deep purple under the filigree mask. My own breath caught when he bent over and sputtered, gasping for air. I almost stood, convinced we were bearing witness to this man's death, but forced myself to breathe, to think, to compile facts like the scientist in training I was. This was only a show, nothing more. Surely no one was going to die. My breath came in short gasps that had nothing to do with the corset of my fine dress. This was utterly thrilling and horrible. I hated it almost as much as I loved it. And I adored it more than I cared to admit.
"Good heavens,"
Miss Prescott muttered when he dropped to his knees wheezing. His eyes rolled backward until all I saw were their whites. I held my own breath, unable to release the tension in my spine. This had to be an illusion.
"Someone help him," Miss Prescott cried. "He's dying."
"Sit down, Olivia," Mrs. Prescott whispered harshly. "You're not only embarrassing yourself, but me and your father as well." Before anyone could aid the ringmaster, he pried the serpent away and drew in air as if he'd been submerged in the seawater we traveled through. I slumped back, and Thomas chuckled, but I couldn't quite pull my gaze from the masked man on stage. Mephistopheles shoved himself into a standing position, staggered a bit, then slowly lifted the snake above his head. Light from the chandeliers caught his mask, turning half his face a furious orange-red. Perhaps he was angry. He'd tested us and found us lacking. What well-dressed monsters we must seem, carrying on with our elegant supper while he fought for his life, all for nothing more than our mere entertainment. He spun in a circle once, twice, and the slithering beast disappeared. I leaned forward, blinking as the ringmaster proudly bowed to the audience again, hands no longer occupied by the serpent. A roar of applause went up. "How in God's name?" I mumbled. There were no boxes or places for him to have hidden the snake. I sincerely hoped it didn't find its way to our table. Thomas would surely faint.
"You might even fall," he called as he somersaulted across the stage, top hat remaining in place without his touching it. "In love."
Mephistopheles tipped the hat, and it tumbled down his arm as if it were an acrobat vaulting over a trapeze. Like any great showman, he held it out so we could see it was a regular top hat, if not a bit gaudy. Once he'd made an entire circuit around the stage, he tossed it in the air, then snatched it back with a snap of his wrist. I watched, unblinking, as he stuck his arm in up to his elbow and yanked out a dozen ink-blue roses. His hat had been utterly ordinary. I was almost certain of it.
"I warn you once more, do not get too attached."
Mephistopheles' voice boomed so loudly, I felt an echo of it in my own chest.
"While we boast death-defying acts, no one escapes its grip forever. Will tonight be the end for some? Will you lose your hearts, or perhaps..."
He grinned over his shoulder at the crowd.
"You will lose your heads."
A spotlight illuminated a crudely painted harlequin doll, which hadn't been there a moment before. Pivoting in a single graceful movement, the ringmaster threw a dagger across the stage. It flew blade over handle, sinking into the doll's neck with a thwack that hushed the audience. For a taut moment, nothing happened. All was wretchedly still. We sat there, scarcely breathing, waiting. The doll's body stubbornly remained pinned to the board it had been propped against. Another moment passed, and Mephistopheles tisked.
"Well, that won't do."
He stomped his feet.
"Everyone, do as I do."
Stomp, stomp, stomp. Passengers obliged, slowly at first, then sent the dining saloon into a vibrating frenzy. China rattled, silverware scuttled across tables, goblets sloshed Merlot onto the expensive linens, our tables now appearing more like crime scenes than elegant spreads. Deciding to let go of my well-bred reserve a bit, I stomped along. Thomas, a bemused expression on his face, followed my lead.
Stomp, stomp, stomp.
The pounding drummed into each of my cells, prompting my blood to pump to the beat. It was animalistic and feral, and yet so thrilling. I could not believe so many lords and ladies and high-born passengers of first class were swept up in the hedonism and debauchery. Mrs. Harvey brought her gloved fists down on the table, adding a new fervor to the sound thrumming in my ears. Miss Prescott did the same. A breath later, the doll's head thumped to the floor, rolling toward the ringmaster's gleaming boots.
Stomp, stomp, stomp.
It seemed no one was quite ready to give up the devil's rhythm once it had started. Mephistopheles was the conductor of this wicked symphony, his hand punching the air as the stomp, stomp, stomping reached a fever pitch.
"Silence!"
he shouted, voice booming above everything else. As if he were a puppet master snipping strings, the clumping of feet ceased. Some in the crowd stood, cheering, while a few men in silk top hats whistled loudly. Miss Prescott rose from her seat, face flushed and eyes bright, completely unaffected by the glare her parents leveled at her.
"Bravo!" she called out, clapping. "I said bravo!"
Mephistopheles gazed at the severed head with a thoughtful expression, as if he was reliving a memory that haunted him. Something wretched enough he'd never escape it, no matter how far he'd run. I imagined, like his elaborate illusions, nothing was quite as it seemed where he was concerned. To my astonishment, he picked up the doll's head and kicked it into the air, where it exploded in fireworks that sprinkled down like fallen stars, burning out before they reached the black and white tiled floor. Silence fell upon us all.
So, I inquire once more, which will you lose before the week is through? Your heart? Your head? Perhaps,
he drawled, face cast in shadows as the chandeliers dimmed slowly before winking out.
You will lose your life, your very soul, to this magical traveling show.
I gasped and held my gloved hands up, but could only make out the barest hint of them. My heart pumped faster as I glanced around the pitch blackness, enraptured yet terrified of what monster might be lurking. Seemed I wasn't the only one intrigued. Excited murmurs rippled through the darkness. The promise of death was as alluring, if not more so, than the prospect of falling in love. What morbid creatures we were, craving danger and mystery in place of happily ever afters.
For now,
he continued, his voice a smooth caress in the dark.
Enjoy an evening of magic, mischief, and mayhem.
My palms dampened, and I couldn't help sitting forward, needing another word, another clue, another bit of the surreal. As if he'd heard my inner longings, Mephistopheles spoke again.
Esteemed passengers of the Etruria, please indulge your senses in the greatest show from sea to sea,
he crooned.
Welcome to Mephistopheles' magnificent minstrel show, or as it's better known, the Moonlight Carnival.
Lights flashed on, the brightness stinging as I blinked dark spots away. A moment later, Mrs. Harvey shoved away from our table, face as pale as a specter. Thomas reached out to steady her, but she raised a shaking hand. I followed her gaze and bit my tongue hard enough to taste copper. Miss Prescott, the young woman clapping with delight moments before, lay face down, unmoving, in a pool of blood, with nearly a dozen knives stuck deep in her velvet-covered back. I stared, waiting for her to gasp out or twitch, to toss her head back and laugh, having fooled us with her performance. But that was an illusion of my own making. Miss Prescott was truly dead.
2. From Dreams to Nightmares. Dining Saloon. RMS Etruria. 1 January, 1889. For a moment, nothing happened, except for the growing ringing in my ears. Thomas might have been calling my name, but I couldn't focus on anything other than forcing myself to breathe. I needed to be rational and analytical, but my emotions weren't quite ready to comply. I studied the dead, but sitting beside a person who'd been murdered was incomprehensible. The room twisted as I stood, and everything became scorchingly hot. I tried convincing myself it was a terrible dream, but Mrs. Prescott's guttural scream erupted, drawing 100 pairs of eyes our way, and I knew it was real. Passengers at other tables gasped, their expressions filled not with repulsion but delight, as they spied the young woman lying in her own blood with 10 dinner knives following the length of her spine. I slowly blinked at the people who were starting to clap, stomach churning, until the truth hit me. They thought this was another act. To most in the saloon, Miss Prescott's murder was simply part of the dinner show, and what a magnificent one it was, according to a man at the next table. Thomas was already out of his seat, his attention torn between his sobbing chaperone and me, all the while scanning the perimeter for threats. I wanted to assist him, to be productive and useful, but I could not stop the shrill ringing in my ears, or the fog that had descended over my thoughts. Everything seemed to move slowly, everything except for my heart, that thundered against my ribs in frantic bursts.
It was a warning beat, urging me to action, begging me to flee.
Olivia!
Mrs. Prescott clutched her daughter's body, tears dripping onto her velvet dress.
Get up! Get up!
Blood smeared across the tablecloth, and Mrs. Prescott's bodice, the color as dark as my churning emotions. Miss Prescott was dead. I could neither process it, nor will my heart to harden and be of use. How could this be? Captain Norwood was suddenly out of his seat and yelling commands I could not decipher through the relentless ringing in my head. Movement around the table finally forced my gaze away from the knives and blood. Diners were being escorted out, though the merriment in the room hadn't quelled. Except for a few at nearby tables, no one looked especially alarmed. I stared down at the horror, uncertain how anyone might mistake it for an illusion. There was so much blood.
What's worse?
Thomas touched my elbow, his brow crinkled. I stared at him without truly seeing anything. A lively young woman lay dead next to me. The world no longer made sense.
Ghastly though it sounds, pretend it is an equation now.
Thomas bent until I met his gaze, his expression as strained as I imagined my own. This wasn't easy for him either. And if he could turn that cool exterior on, then I could too. Shaking myself from my own horror, I rushed to Mrs. Prescott's side and gently took her hands in mine. It was both to comfort her and preserve the crime scene. Through my storm of emotions, I clutched at one fact. A murderer was on board this ship, and we needed to isolate clues quickly. As gruesome as it was, we couldn't disturb the body, at least not yet.
Come, I said as tenderly as I could.
Olivia! Mrs. Prescott wailed.
Sit up!
Look at me, Ruth. Only at me.
Mr. Prescott interrupted his wife's screams. There was an edge in his voice that carved through her growing hysteria. She straightened, though her lips trembled.
Go to our chambers and instruct Farley to give you a warm brandy. I'll send Dr. Arden at once.
I made to go with her when a warm hand came down on my shoulder. Thomas squeezed it in comfort, his golden brown eyes serious as he inspected me.
I'll escort Mrs. Prescott and Mrs. Harvey to their chambers, then fetch your uncle.
He didn't ask if I'd be all right staying with the body. He trusted I would be. I stared at him a moment more, his confidence proving a balm to my raw nerves, soothing my fears. I nodded once, took another deep breath, then faced the table. Captain Norwood stared at a playing card stuck to Miss Prescott's back I hadn't noticed. It was directly in the center of her spine. My blood chilled. Whoever had thrown the knife had impaled the card through the blade first. A potential warning and a clue.
I'll need this area to be left precisely as it is, Captain, I said, falling back on months of forensic training while Thomas guided the two women out.
Uncle would be proud. I'd collected my emotions like anatomical specimens and stored them away to dissect later.
You'll also need to question everyone in this room.
The lights were out, Miss Wadsworth.
Norwood swallowed hard, his focus sliding back to the knives in Miss Prescott's spine and the torn card.
I doubt they witnessed anything useful.
I longed to smack him upside the head with that obvious remark. The lights had only been out briefly. Someone might have noticed suspicious behavior prior to that.
Humor me then, sir,
I said, using my best authoritative tone. The captain clamped his jaw. It was one thing to hear commands from a man, but from a 17-year-old girl it was quite another. For the sake of the murdered woman before us, I let my annoyance go.
My uncle is an expert with reading a crime scene, I added, sensing the captain's wavering decision. It's what he'd advise.
He ran a hand down his face. A death on the first night of the Moonlight Carnival didn't bode well for his future plans.
Very well. I'll send crew to everyone's rooms tonight.
At a signal from the captain, attendants swept into the saloon like a well-dressed army, ushering members of first class out as calmly as they could. A few guests threw nervous glances our way, but most were excitedly chattering on about how lifelike the performance was, how real the blood appeared, and how on earth had the ringmaster managed to make the knives in the back look so authentic. Captain Norwood said nothing to confirm or deny these theories. He stood, face grim, and bid the passengers good evening. As the room emptied, an uncomfortable feeling tingled down my own spine. I turned, surprised to find Mephistopheles staring from the stage, expression impossible to read behind his mask. Unlike the others, however, his attention wasn't on the murdered girl. He was watching me. His gaze was heavy, almost tangible, and I wondered what he'd seen or might know. I took a step in his direction, intent on asking him these questions and more. But he faded into the shadows and disappeared for good. The chamber we'd been offered for Miss Prescott's post-mortem reminded me of a dank cave. We were deep within the bowels of the Etruria, and being so near the boiler system, the temperature was unpleasantly warm, and the lights flickered a bit too often, as if the ship itself was nervous about what dark deeds were to come. I was grateful for the refrigeration on board. We wouldn't keep the body in this chamber for long, lest it swell with rot overnight and attract vermin. Goose flesh tickled my skin despite the heat. No matter how hard I fought to think otherwise, I could not escape from memories of another sinister laboratory. One where the world churned sounds still managed to tiptoe through my nightmares some evenings. The bad dreams were less frequent than in weeks past, but they haunted me from time to time, painful reminders of all that I'd lost during the autumn of terror. Ignoring the hiss of steam emanating from an exposed pipe, I focused on Uncle Jonathan as he rolled up his shirt sleeves and proceeded to scrub with carbolic soap. When he finished, I walked around the examination table, sprinkling sawdust to soak up any blood or fluids that might leak onto the floor. Rituals were necessary parts of our work. They helped keep our hearts and minds clear, according to Uncle.
"Before I remove the knives, I want physical details written down."
Uncle's tone was as cool as the metal scalpels I'd laid out on the makeshift tray.
"Height, weight, and so on. Audrey Rose, I'll need my..."
I handed his apron over, then tied my own about my waist. I hadn't changed out of my evening attire, and the juxtaposition of my fine silk gown against the plain apron reminded me of how unpredictable life could be. I doubted when Miss Prescott woke this morning, she feared she'd be lying face down on our examination table, stabbed with knives, starting from the base of her skull and ending just near her tailbone. Thomas picked up a notebook and nodded toward me, expression determined. He and I were well versed in our macabre roles, having practiced many times in more than one country. It seemed no matter where we went, death followed, and like greedy misers, we stored data away, profiting, in a sense, from loss. I'd provide the scientific findings and he'd record them. A team in all ways. I dug around inside Uncle's leather medical satchel until I found the measuring tape. I held it from crown to toe as I'd been taught, my mind clearing with the familiar task. Now wasn't the time to reflect on all the things Miss Prescott longed to do in life. Now it was time to read her corpse for clues. I didn't believe in revenge, but it was hard not to seek justice for her. "Deceased is a female named Miss Olivia Prescott, approximately 165 centimeters and 18 years of age," I said, pausing for Thomas to scratch the information down. He looked up, my signal to continue. "I'd put her weight around 7.5 stone.
"Good."
Uncle lined up the scalpels, bone saws, and scissors I'd need for the internal examination next.
"Cause of death."
I tore my gaze from the cadaver.
"I beg your pardon, sir, but there's nearly a dozen knives protruding from her back. Isn't her cause of death rather obvious? I'm sure one or more of them either pierced her heart or lungs, or severed her spinal column."
He turned his sharp, green-eyed focus on mine, and I fought the urge to shrink away. Clearly, I'd forgotten an important lesson.
"As forensic examiners, we cannot shut off other avenues to search. What have I taught you about trusting only that which you see?"
As far as admonishments went, it wasn't the worst, but my face still flamed under his scrutiny.
You're correct. I suppose it's possible the knives have been poisoned, or that Miss Prescott was killed through other means and the knives were a distraction. She did expire rather quickly, and quietly.
Very good, Uncle nodded. It's imperative we keep our emotions and theories in check while performing a post-mortem. Otherwise we run the risk of influencing our findings, or becoming so distraught we work ourselves into a fit, like your Aunt Amelia.
Uncle closed his eyes, and I had the distinct impression he hadn't wished to speak of her. Aunt Amelia? I drew my brows together.
What's happened to upset her? Is Father all right?
An uncomfortably long pause followed my question, and Uncle seemed at a loss for words. I gripped the measuring tape in my hands, knowing anything that took this long for him to compose a response to couldn't be good. He finally shot Thomas a pinched-lipped look, as if he wasn't certain he wanted his other protégé to hear what he had to say, then sighed.
It seems Liza's gone missing.
Missing? That can't be right.
The shrill ringing in my head from earlier was back. I took an unsteady step away from the corpse, lest I faint onto it.
I received a letter from her only last week.
I shut my mouth, trying to recount when my cousin's letter had been dated. I couldn't recall, but there hadn't been anything out of the ordinary. She'd been happy, secretly meeting with a young man. There was no harm in innocent flirtations.
Surely Aunt Amelia is overreacting. Liza is probably off with...
I hadn't seen Thomas stand up, but he caught my eye across the small room. If Liza had run off with the young man she'd last written about, it would be a devastating blow to our family and reputation. No wonder Uncle had hesitated in front of Thomas.
Uncle rubbed his temples. I'm afraid the news comes from your father. Amelia is beside herself with grief and hasn't left her chambers in more than a week. Liza went out one afternoon and never returned home. Your father worries she may be dead.
Dead? She can't...
My stomach seemed to fall through my knees. Either it was the ocean travel or the news, but I was about to be sick. Without offering another word, I rushed from the room, not wanting to witness the disappointment in my uncle's eyes, as my emotions erupted from the box I'd set them in and consumed me. I huddled into my cloak, watching from the chilly promenade deck as the sun dipped toward the horizon, turning the dark, churning waves the color of clotted blood. The steady sound of water striking the hull was like a siren's call, luring victims in, promising all would be well if one simply took a leap of faith and entered her underwater dominion.
What have you gotten yourself into this time, cousin?
I sighed, the puff of warm air mingling with the cold ocean mist. In response, waves bashed against the side of our ship, distressed and restless, and perhaps a little desperate to shove us back to England. Back to where I had a chance, even a bleak one, of finding Liza. How quickly dreams dissolved into nightmares. Despite the impossibility before me, I refused to submit to the fact that I was stranded at sea, powerless to assist those I loved. I could not believe Father allowed me to leave England without telling me my cousin was missing. I thought we'd gotten past his sheltering ways after he'd permitted me to study forensic medicine in Romania. But I was clearly wrong. Even though it wasn't my fault, I felt as though I'd already failed Miss Prescott. And now Liza.
I will not fail again, I swore aloud.
There was only one line I would never cross, murder. Taking a life from a person, that would make me no better than the murderers I hoped to thwart. A cruel voice in my head whispered that I'd never actually stopped them. I simply gathered clues made of blood and bone and tried piecing them together before more bodies were added to the unending tally. To truly end a murderer, I'd need to become one. I eyed the lifeboats hanging against the wall of the promenade, wondering if I possessed enough physical strength to wrangle one down and row myself back to England. I clenched my teeth and faced the water, Salt and sea mist stung my nose, the spray rising in the icy air and coating my face. It woke me up from nonsensical visions. Behind me a door swung open, revealing a tall figure gilded by light. The background din of staff cleaning up after the terrible opening show accentuated his own silence. He stood there, too shrouded in shadows for me to make out his features. But judging from the involuntary flutter in my chest, it was Thomas. As he approached the railing where I stood, I noticed a telegram peeking out from his overcoat pocket. I wondered if it was from my father, and if he'd sent word to everyone aboard this ship except for me. If anyone had hurt Liza, I would kill them, slowly. I almost smiled, finding the thought didn't disturb me one bit.
"If I didn't know any better, Wadsworth, my dear," Thomas said, voice laced with teasing, his typical method of distracting me from my darkness. "I'd believe you were about to perform your own escape act. Am I to be your assistant, then?"
He stared down at himself, frowning slightly.
"I left my sequined dragon frock coat in London, and this one's a bit plain. It doesn't particularly scream carnival chic."
"Actually, I was contemplating murder."
"Not mine, I hope."
He leaned over the railing and glanced sideways at me.
"Though I am rather handsome in this suit. I suppose if it's my time to go, I might as well go in style. Be sure to keep my face intact. I want you to swoon and mourn at my funeral."
I nearly groaned. "That's in poor taste, considering recent events." I nudged him with my elbow as he sighed. "I still choose you, even with your shortcomings, Cresswell."
"It's my wit, isn't it?"
Thomas faced me, a tentative smile starting.
"You can't bear to be apart from it. Honestly, I'm surprised you haven't informed your uncle about the claim you've staked upon me. Seems like news you'd enjoy sharing."
There was a question in his eyes, but I quickly gazed back at the ocean, pretending to have missed it. The stars were out in full force tonight, twinkling and shimmering across the undulating sea. It reminded me of the painting Thomas made for me the week before, an orchid that held the entire universe within its petals. It amazed me that the world could resume its orbit, no matter what destruction had been wrought. I wondered how Mrs. Prescott was feeling, if she'd been given her brandy and was floating somewhere between dreams and nightmares. Perhaps I ought to join her. I felt Thomas studying me, but no longer had the urge to mask my expression as I used to. He opened his mouth, then shut it, causing me to puzzle over what he might have said. Perhaps he'd grown as weary of having the same debate. I didn't wish to tell anyone of our eventual betrothal until we'd spoken to my father. Thomas saw it as hesitancy on my part, a notion so ridiculous I refused to acknowledge it at all. We simply did not have the luxury of time to visit with Father and inform him of our intentions while we raced to the ship, as much as I wanted to. There wasn't any part of me that didn't long to be with him forever. After everything we'd been through over the last month, I thought he'd know that. A moment later, he wrapped an arm around my shoulders and tugged me near, safe in his indiscretion, since we were alone on the freezing deck. I relaxed into his embrace, letting the warmth of his body and the scent of his cologne comfort me.
"I cannot promise all will be well, Audrey Rose."
I exhaled loudly. "This is one of those times it's all right to lie, Thomas. I'm quite aware of how dire things are, but I'd like to pretend otherwise, at least for a few moments."
"Right,"
he said, turning his thoughts inward.
"What I mean is, I promise to stand by your side through whatever comes our way. You'll end up being the hero, no doubt, but I'll look good beside you. And that's what truly counts."
"Honestly?"
He drew back, feigning being affronted. "You can't possibly have all the glory, good-looking and the hero. This is one of those times it's all right to lie, Wadsworth."
"Have you no..." He brushed his lips against mine, and I forgot about my worries, just as he'd intended. The kiss started off tentative and sweet, a distraction and promise itself, but soon turned deeper and more urgent. I wound my arms around his neck, bringing him closer, getting lost in the rhythm of both the sea and our kiss. Even on the coldest night, he could ignite a fire within me. I worried that one day the blaze might consume me entirely. Much too soon, he broke away. In times like this, I thought he was right. We ought to announce our intentions and marry immediately. Then I might kiss him whenever I pleased.
"Shall I say the thing I'm not supposed to?"
he asked, his tone serious. I drew in a deep breath. For him to acknowledge hesitance meant I most certainly did not want to hear it. "We've promised not to lie to each other."
"All right. Here are the facts."
He studied me again, his expression controlled but kind.
"There's nothing to be done about Liza from here. We can make arrangements to return to London once we reach America, but for now, we have the very real issue of a murderer aboard our ship. It may be an isolated incident, but I don't believe it will be."
Gooseflesh marched along my arms. Thomas's deductions were hardly ever wrong. If he believed there might be more murders, it was only a matter of time before we found the bodies. "What do you suggest we do?" I asked, rubbing my hands over my sleeves.
"I'm glad you asked. I've been thinking on this quite a bit."
"And?"
"I'm in favor of hiding in your chamber for the remainder of the week."
A smile twitched across his lips as I raised a brow.
"Drinking, kissing, debauching ourselves until we arrive in New York."
He sighed dreamily.
"You must admit, we'd be safe from the murderer, deliriously happy. And both of those options are much better than standing over cadavers."
I rolled my eyes. "Or we could finish the post-mortem and see what we find."
"A less fun but more valiant choice as always, Wadsworth. Though your uncle wishes to resume the post-mortem tomorrow, per the captain's request."
He exhaled, though there was a troublesome gleam in his eyes.
"I've been tasked with escorting you to bed. A difficult job, but one I shall take very seriously, I assure you."
I shook my head. Thomas had dragged me from the deepest parts of my worries and restored my focus, all while managing to steal another kiss. I couldn't say that his method wasn't appealing, as we made our way down the promenade, arm in arm. 3. Ace of Clubs. Audrey Rose's Quarters, RMS Etruria, 1 January, 1889. An attendant braided my hair and helped me into a cotton nightgown with lace-trimmed sleeves without uttering a word. While the majority of passengers still believed Miss Prescott's murder was an elaborate show, most of the crew aboard the ship seemed to hold their breath along with their tongues, unsure if another nightmare would soon be unleashed. Once she'd gone, I released an exhausted sigh and glanced around. My chambers were handsomely appointed, with a marble nightstand, a carved vanity, a small table and chairs, and a wardrobe that would have pleased King Louis with all its gold embellishments. However, the industrial-sized bolts and steel surrounding the small window couldn't hide the truth of where I was. Despite the lavish dressings, a chill seeped in through the cracks. Our luxurious ship was nothing more than a floating prison. I pulled a pair of thick stockings on and lay on my bed, knowing sleep was the last thing I'd accomplish with so many thoughts spinning through my mind. I picked up the ace of clubs I'd found staked to Miss Prescott's body and inspected it. What connection did it have to this murder? I mulled over a few potential clues, the most prominent having to do with magic tricks. Sleight of hand was something I'd not given much thought to before, though I'd seen street magicians roll cards across their knuckles in London. They must practice for long hours to make it appear so fluid a motion, their deception flawless to an untrained eye. Not too different from a cunning murderer. Crime scenes were filled with their own sort of sleight of hand. Murderers tried fabricating scenes, manipulating them to cover their true intentions and identity. Mephistopheles was gifted in the art of misdirection, something based in fact, not fantasy. He made a person look one way when they ought to do the exact opposite. If he hadn't been on stage when Miss Prescott was killed, he'd be the most likely culprit. I sat up, heart racing, as I finally understood my earlier preoccupation with the young ringmaster. I wanted to learn his very particular skills, utilizing that part of my brain while placing myself in the minds of deviants and murderers would be most beneficial. Something niggled around the edges of my mind, some hazy, far-flung idea that would be nearly impossible to pull off. If I could mislead Thomas Cresswell, make him believe the impossible that my feelings had shifted, then I'd know for certain I was an expert at that art form. Abandoning that plan, I settled back into my pillows and flipped the ace of clubs over, searching for significance. It was sliced through its center and stained with dried blood, but the back had the most interesting design. A raven, dark as ink, opened its wings against a silver moon. Vines and thorns were intricately woven around the card's edges in thick black strokes. On both the top and bottom center, a strange double eight lay on its side, overlapping itself. I avoided touching the place where the knife had torn it, still in denial that Miss Prescott had been slain right beside me, and I hadn't been any the wiser. If only Uncle hadn't... A soft knock came at the door connecting my room and my chaperone's, startling me from my ruminations. I pushed myself up, deposited the card on my nightstand, and wrapped an embroidered orchid dressing robe about me. Goose flesh rose, though it wasn't from surprise. The watered silk was cool and smooth as liquid against the parts of my skin not covered by my nightgown. "Come in!" "It's only me, dear." Mrs. Harvey opened the door, a small tea service balanced on her ample hip. "Thought you could do with something warm. I also brought my traveling tonic, just in case you'd like something a bit warmer." I smiled, recalling the clever name she'd given her spirits when we'd traveled to Romania last month. Her engraved flask teetered on the tray. The sharp scent of alcohol was detectable from where I sat, and I decided it would indeed warm me quickly, and perhaps burn a hole through my stomach in the process. "Tea will do for now, thank you." I went to join her at the small table, but she stopped me with a firm shake of her head. She poured tea, then tucked me back into bed, pushing the steaming cup into my hands. Bergamot and rose immediately scented the air, relaxing me at once. "Thank you."
"There, there, child."
She plopped down beside me and took a generous swig of her tonic.
"No need to thank me. I was simply in need of a bit of company myself. Makes the traveling tonic go down easier."
Her gaze drifted over to the card on my nightstand. "Wealth." "Pardon?" I asked, wondering if she'd already been sipping her tonic.
"My husband used to dabble in cartomancy, reading fortunes in playing cards, in his youth.
It was how we met." A wistfulness entered her expression. "He was dreadful at it, God rest his soul, though he was quite talented in other areas."
"How are you faring?" I asked, quickly changing the subject. I didn't wish to find out which talents she was dreamily recalling. "It's been quite a day." "I don't know how you and my Thomas do what you do and keep your wits about you," she said, snapping back to the present. "But I'm proud of you both. You make a fine pair, you know, in your apprenticeship and in other ways. Has Thomas made his intentions clear?"
I stuck my face in my cup, hoping the steam could be blamed for the flush creeping onto my skin.
"Yes. Well, that is, I believe he wishes to speak with my father."
"He's not conventional. Lord help him, he's got much to learn about using those manners of his. But his heart is good."
Mrs. Harvey took another sip, eyeing me over her spectacles.
"You will make him very happy, Audrey Rose. But most important, I believe he will also make you very happy."
She wiped at wetness in the corner of her eye.
"It's not proper, but here."
Without saying more, she handed over a folded note. There was no name on it, and no envelope. I looked up quickly. "What's this?" Mrs. Harvey gathered her flask and moved toward the door, lifting a shoulder.
"I haven't the slightest notion what you mean, dear. I'm simply an old woman who came to say good evening. I sleep like the dead,
so you'll have to shout if you need me. I most certainly wouldn't hear if your door opened and closed. With a wink, she closed the door to our chambers, leaving me gaping after her. Clearly she hadn't been as unaware of Thomas's flirtations last month as she had appeared. Without thinking too hard on how he'd convinced her to take part in this new scheme, I unfolded the paper. A short message in neat script greeted me. I wondered who'd written it, until I read it. "If you'd please, I beg for you to meet me near the starboard side of the bow at midnight. Alone." My pulse thrummed at the proposition contained in one small line. It wasn't the first time Thomas had requested we meet somewhere at such an indecent hour, unchaperoned. This time, however, we weren't in a mostly empty boarding school in Romania, far from inquisitive eyes. If we were to be caught alone here, amongst the upper class, I'd be deemed a trollop, my reputation destroyed. Then again, perhaps Thomas had deduced a new theory, or discovered another clue that might unveil Miss Prescott's murderer. My wretched curiosity whirled with possibilities. I stared at the note a moment more, biting my lip, surprised Thomas would have an attendant take down such a personal message. I could pretend as if I'd never received it, do the polite and decent thing expected of me. But that path was so utterly dull. I thought of Thomas's lips on mine, imagined his hands tangled in my dark hair, our breath coming in short gasps as his hands slowly traveled over me, exploring and teasing. Acceptable or not, I craved his touch. My eyes snapped to the small clock ticking away on my nightstand. It was nearly midnight now. I glanced down at my silk robe and lace-trimmed nightgown, the ruffles on my sleeves falling across my fingers. There wasn't enough time to get dressed and rush all the way to the starboard side of the boat without being seen. Yet showing up in my current state would cause embolisms should I run into anyone else who'd decided on a midnight stroll. Which sounded precisely like the sort of deviant plan Thomas would make. "Scoundrel," I smiled, then tossed my winter cloak on, grabbed a scalpel from my medical bag just to be safe, and hoped for the best as I crept out my door. During daylight hours, the Etruria inspired feelings of grand travel and frivolity, what with its massive masts and large steam funnels. Hardwood floors had been buffed and polished until sunshine gleamed like diamonds from them, and the roof above the promenade deck was a beautiful addition to the pearly corridor of first class. At night, those same features felt haunted, dangerous. The overhang was more akin to an open mouth, waiting to chomp down on guests. The same shining floors were now reminiscent of a salivating tongue. Lifeboats secured to the wall were actually perfect hiding places instead of quaint miniatures. The immense sails snapped around as if they were wings of some enormous sea creature hunting fresh meat. Smokestacks exhaled, the fog lingering around the railing, watching. Anything might be lurking in the mist, or more appropriately, anyone. "Foolish," I whispered, pulling my fur-trimmed cloak tighter as icy fingers meandered down my skin. If Miss Prescott hadn't been murdered, I'd blame my overactive imagination for morphing the boat into a gargantuan creature. But there truly could be something hiding in the shadows, hoping to sink its claws into my back next. I decided I didn't care for sea travel one bit. Thomas would do better to choose a more reasonable place for any future clandestine meetings, preferably indoors, near a fire, far from empty corridors and thrashing waters. Teeth chattering, I hurried down the promenade, attention snagging on anything that seemed out of place, though it was hard to know exactly what didn't belong. I'd never travelled on such a vessel before. Wind whipped down the open corridor with a low warning howl. Ropes creaked. Each new sound was like a needle pricking my veins. I held my scalpel tightly at my side, not wanting to strike out at anyone by mistake. I needed to rein in my emotions, or someone could get hurt. I longed to kiss Thomas, not accidentally eviscerate him. As I neared the front of the ship, I slowed my pace. I didn't see my future betrothed, but surely he had to have arrived